This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest was the first woman to serve as Chief Justice of Iowa's Supreme Court when she was selected for that position in 2006. That was after serving on Iowa's highest court since 1993. But she is perhaps best known as one of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices dismissed by Iowa voters 3 years ago. That was November 2010, following the High Court's decision which legalized same-sex marriage in our state, known as the Varnum decision. It marked the first time that an Iowa Supreme Court justice was not retained since the retention system was adopted for Iowa justices in 1962. In 2012, the three justices who were not retained received Profile in Courage awards from the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation for their role in the Varnum decision. Marcia Ternus currently practices law in Des Moines. She also serves as the director of the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. That's a part-time position. This coming Tuesday, Marcia Ternus will be speaking as part of the University of Iowa lecture series. The title of her lecture, Restoring Justice in the U.S. That's next Tuesday, November 12th, in the Old Capitol Senate Chamber, starting at 7:30, and it's free and open to the public. Marcia Ternus joins us for this half hour. Justice Ternus, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Restoring Justice in the U.S., the title of your lecture. Tell us a little bit about the messages you want to put out there.
Well, I think that a system of justice could produce better results than what we're currently doing in the United States. We have a great fixation in our criminal justice system on punishment. And because we are so fixated on punishing offenders, that leaves little resources or time to address the needs of victims, to provide for the rehabilitation of offenders. Our communities in the short run and the long run would be much better if we had healing of victims and if we had rehabilitated offenders who could become productive members of our communities.
Mm-hmm. So tell me how that looks on the ground in the court system and then afterwards when offenders are sentenced.
Well, I think its manifestation in the court system occurs through the sentences that are provided by the legislature. There's very little judicial discretion when it comes to imposing a sentence. Most of the sentences are, for at least the most serious crimes, are spelled out in a term of years. A lot of crimes carry mandatory minimums, which means that you have to serve a certain amount of time in jail. Legislatures nationally over the last several decades have continued to increase the length of sentences and the number of mandatory minimums, as well as just the sheer number of crimes that one could commit. As a result of that, our prison populations have swelled. America, the U.S., imprisons our citizens at a rate that is astronomically greater than what other countries do. And because of that, I think we've all seen in our lifetime the necessity of building more and more prisons. The cost of imprisonment is quite high. Obviously, if we're spending precious tax dollars on prisons and prison guards, that leaves little to spend on giving offenders the education, the coping skills, perhaps the drug treatment or mental health treatment that they need to not commit crimes in the future and to become productive, happy citizens.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've reviewed hundreds of criminal proceedings. Can you tell me in specifics, does a specific case or cases, do they leap out at you as something that we can grasp onto as an illustration of what you just mentioned?
Well, I can't think of any particular case that I could give you by name, but I do know that during my 17 years on the court, there were times when I read a record in a criminal matter and realized that the individual who had committed the offense would be much better served and our communities better served by treatment for a drug addiction, for example. That locking somebody up in prison doesn't give them the anger management skills, for example, that they might need. In fact, prison only reinforces the idea that aggressiveness is the way to handle conflict. And so I did, yes, I did see that in the cases. I can't think of anyone in particular, but there were times when the law called for a mandatory sentence in prison. And I just had the feeling this is not going to lead to anything good.
Mm-hmm. Can all offenders be rehabilitated, or would you say a percentage of them fall into the category that you're talking about? Some of them really do belong behind bars.
No doubt about it. There are individuals who need to be locked up.
With no hope of rehabilitation.
Yes, that I'm sure that's probably true, yes.
Do you have a sense of how many we're talking about?
I don't have a sense of how many we're talking about, but it's a lot less than the number of people we're locking up for sure. In the U.S., we lock up a lot of nonviolent offenders, which is not customary in other countries. These are people that we aren't afraid of, but we're mad at them. So we lock them away. And what I hope to do is challenge the audience to stop, to not get caught up in the rhetoric of being tough on crime as if that solves all of society's problems, and to step back and look at what happens to victims, look at what might have led offenders to do what they did, what could be done to heal the victim, the offender, and our communities.
Mm-hmm. This comes at a time when across the country we're seeing states move to decriminalize growing and selling and use of marijuana. You were speaking before a college audience on Tuesday. Is that a mere coincidence when you talk about such things? It seems like it matches with what you're saying, that perhaps there are a lot of those people in jails now who would not be there had pot, had marijuana been less of a criminal offense.
That's true. The decriminalization of marijuana has really been quite a quick and relatively recent phenomenon, and one that was not occurring really as my views on this were developing over the time that I was on the court. But I think that the fact the prisons are filled with drug offenders is an example of a segment of the prison population that we might ask ourselves, would we accomplish more by treating these individuals for their drug addiction rather than locking them up? While I was on the court, and even I think before I joined the court, there was some utilization of drug courts where individuals who, but for their drug addiction, were felt to be very low risk for committing crimes. And a much more holistic approach is used in those courts to provide treatment and support and make sure these individuals have job skills and a place to live so that they can get their life back on track. And that benefits not only them, but it benefits us as a society when that happens. So, yeah, I think nonviolent drug offenders, low-level drug offenders, are an example of individuals who could benefit from a more holistic approach to criminal justice.
You're saying we should put more emphasis on rehabilitation, less on punishment, the punitive aspect of our justice system. Granted, it does take a lot of money to house all the prisoners, build the prisons, to have all the staff for these, but it does take a lot of resources to try to rehabilitate people. Where does that money come from?
Well, I think you can use some of the money that's being spent on housing individuals in prisons on rehabilitation. And I think there is also a need to maybe invest up front in mental health treatment, drug treatment, job skills, training, personal skills in terms of anger management and coping skills. And the reason that's a good investment to make up front is that it breaks this cycle that can occur when an individual is thrown in prison, then his or her family is left fractured, with the children missing a parent and having the stigma, because, gosh, there is a stigma in our society for being in prison, that translates into their children having the stigma of a parent in prison. And so the ripple effect of what we do, it destroys families. It destroys entire segments of our culture because our criminal law is disproportionately impacted impacts minorities, for example. So by investing now in rehabilitating individuals, providing them the treatment that they need, we are not only rehabilitating that individual, but we are restoring their family to a level of functioning that they don't currently have. And so the more healthy families we have, the healthier our community is. So it's just a win-win all around.
I think a few moments ago you used the phrase like in other countries. Now, would you point to one or two other countries where you say we could learn a lot from that country?
I don't have my notes in front of me, but I know if you compare our rate of imprisonment to countries such as Canada, Germany, England, France, the disparities of the rate at which we imprison nonviolent offenders compared to those countries is a staggering difference.
If you just joined us, my guest for this half hour is the former Chief Justice of Iowa's Supreme Court, Marcia Ternus. Following the unanimous Varnum decision that legalized same-sex marriage in Iowa, that was in 2009, groups opposed to same-sex marriage organized a campaign against you and as Chief Justice, and also the two other justices who were up for the next retention vote in 2010, Justice David Baker and Justice Michael Streit. The campaign against you included some heavy support from out-of-state conservative and religious groups, and in that 2010 retention vote, the three of you were not retained. It marked the first time in Iowa Supreme Court that justices were not retained since that system was put in place in 1962. Then 1 year ago, in November of 2012, voters retained Justice David Wiggins, the one judge who participated in Varnum, whose retention was on that ballot, and by a margin of 54% to 46%. What have you seen in this relatively short time in terms of the change that has taken place in the state since you and two other justices were ousted and we see David Wiggins staying?
Well, I'm really happy that he was retained. He should have been retained. He's a very competent justice, and the voters did the right thing by him. I think that there are several factors that account for the different result in the 2010 election compared to the 2012 election. And one of the most obvious differences is that public opinion with respect to same-sex marriage or marriage equality has shifted quite a bit in this state and nationally. Because of that difference in public opinion, I think there was less motivation on the part of voters to punish someone for a decision that they now agreed with. And so that is one of the factors that I believe accounts for the difference. I also think that there was much more preparation by individuals and organizations who supported retention in 2012 than there was in 2010. We were caught flat-footed, I believe, in 2010. There had never been a challenge to a member of the Supreme Court in the past. We really didn't have the mechanisms set up to
And you didn't go to the public. That. You didn't make your case. Why did you not make your case?
Well, the three of us could, under the Judicial Ethics Code, have formed campaign committees and raised money. But we discussed whether we should do that, and the three of us agreed with really little hesitation that we shouldn't do it. We thought it was unseemly for judges to be out campaigning like politicians. We received our appointments under a merit-based system, not because of our politics or our political connections. And so it would have been contrary to the way we viewed our office to be out there on the campaign trail. We also didn't want to be raising money for our campaign to retain our seats and then face the prospect as sitting judges of seeing those very attorneys or parties who might have contributed to our campaigns appearing before us in court, which would have required us to recuse ourselves. Part of the philosophy of a Supreme Court is that all seven perspectives, hopefully diverse perspectives, are brought to bear on each case that comes before the Supreme Court. Had we started to recuse one, two, or three of us, then the court wouldn't have functioned in the way it's intended to function. So there were really quite a number of reasons that fed into our decision, one which I will say we don't regret.
On Tuesday of this week, the Illinois House of Representatives voted to allow same-sex couples to wed, and this clears the way for Illinois to become the 15th state, along with the District of Columbia, to permit gay couples to marry. It's a remarkable short amount of time when consider Iowa was in a very small group, the third state in the U.S. to give that right to same-sex couples. But I wonder, in the meantime, have you thought, with all the states and the legislative action in those other states, would it have been better had Iowa legalized same-sex marriage through the legislature or perhaps have a referendum?
Better for what? It certainly wouldn't have been better for the Constitution. When we took our oath of office, we swore that we would uphold the Constitution of the state of Iowa without fear, favor, or hope of reward. And that is what motivated our decision. In our view, it was about equality. It was about whether the guarantee of equal rights made in our Constitution, our state Constitution, meant something. The fact that the law was being applied to same-sex marriage was ancillary to a certain extent. And so I think our role as judges was to uphold the Constitution, and it certainly would not have been better for us to shirk that duty.
You were not retained, along with Justices Baker and Strite, in the 2010 election. I'm wondering what you consider a reasonable justification for ousting a judge. You obviously don't agree with it in your case. You had a unanimous decision in this case, and you explained the reasons for that and have many times in the meantime. But what sorts of things would a judge do you think that would be reasonable justification for being ousted?
Well, I think that there are times when an individual can be appointed to a position, and in retrospect, you see the person really isn't functioning the way they should. So a judge may not have a good judicial demeanor, may, in terms of the respect accorded parties. And
behavior in the courtroom.
Yeah, behavior in the courtroom. It might be statements made that indicate some kind of bias or prejudice that would be totally inappropriate with a member of the judiciary. Anything that is competency, performance related, and it would certainly be helpful, I think, to voters in any state where there is a judicial election if there were a performance evaluation made of judges. And in fact, while I was on the court, we discussed the possibility of initiating that. Colorado has a very robust system for judicial performance evaluations. And I think that information then helps voters decide, is this individual performing as we expect judges to perform? But that, of course, in my view, is something quite different than punishing a judge who has, in fact, followed the law, but has reached a result that an individual might find distasteful.
A couple more minutes left with Justice Ternus, former Chief Justice of Iowa's Supreme Court, Marcia Ternus. You are now, as a part-time position, director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. That's located at Drake University. What is the mission of that institute?
We are a bipartisan institute that will focus on facilitating discussion of important public policy issues. We will also be focusing on citizen engagement in the political process and encouraging respectful and constructive dialogue regarding important public policy issues.
When you want to facilitate different sorts of conversations, change the nature of our conversations, what are the specific goals? What do you see out there that can be improved specifically?
Well, I think we can have discussions rather than debates. I don't think it is productive, and I think we see examples of it all the time, for a program to simply say, we're going to talk about issue A, and we have speaker one who will give a view of issue A according to, you know, his views, and then speaker two who will give exactly the opposite view. And so those speakers get up and they give their views and the audience asks questions, and then I guess the audience picks sides. You know, it's A or B, it's black or white.
And your alternative? And
my alternative is that there should be a discussion of how the issue is viewed by these individuals that will lead into a discussion of where's the commonality? How can these differences be bridged so that something can be done that will move society forward in addressing the issue that's the subject of the discussion?
And I understand the Harkin Institute also has programming focusing on the coming presidential caucuses in 2016. We don't have much time, but briefly, what is that?
Well, we hope to identify the issues that are important to voters, that will be important to voters in the election, and we hope to encourage candidates for the office of president to address those issues when they're in Iowa.
We've done that before in other caucuses. I guess I'm asking what the Harkin Institute, how the caucuses will change with the Harkin Institute active.
Well, I think we hope to provide a forum that will allow candidates who are interested to know that they can come to the Harkin Institute. We have the information they need. We can provide a locale for them to talk maybe around a kitchen table with families, to do community events or to give a lecture in Des Moines, to really be more organized and methodical in the approach that we take to the caucuses. And like I said, to encourage a higher level of debate. Now, you know, that is really aspirational, and it's probably going to take decades for that to really have a meaningful result. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't aspire to it.
Justice Marcia Ternus, I want to thank you for coming into our studio today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Marcia Ternus will be speaking as part of the University of Iowa lecture series. The title of her lecture, Restoring Justice in the U.S., that will take place Tuesday, November 12th in the Old Capitol Senate Chamber. The starting time is 7:30 and admission is free. Thank you again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we take a look at news literacy, especially for future generations. How, for instance, do you get high-quality, reliable reporting in an age when a sensational tweet or YouTube video can dominate the news cycle? We'll find out when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.